Now, Dr. Dud Mader has animals arriving daily to his clinic who rely on him to safeguard their health. However, because of where the veterinary clinic is, he also has to protect his staff. Here to tell us more, welcome to the show, Dr. Dud Mader.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. And you, it's morning there, is it, where you are?
It sure is. It's a little bit after 8 o'clock.
I believe you're in, or your clinic is in downtown LA. Now, for us in Spain, what sort of area is that then?
Well, actually, I live on an island in the Caribbean right now. But the story was based out of the hospital that was in Los Angeles.
Okay, and I believe it's, we're talking about the Rodney King case, the 1990s civil unrest.
Right. So our hospital was right on the cusp of the, let's say, the affluent part of town and the poor part of town. So we were right on the border. And in one direction, we had million-dollar mansions. In the other direction, we had families that could barely afford to put shoes on their children's feet.
Wow, crazy. And I believe you had to contend with gangs and drive-by shootings, riots, all sorts of things.
Yeah, it was certainly an interesting time in my life. I like to think of this book to be very similar to the James Herriot books, the British veterinarian that penned the series All Creatures Great and Small back in the 1970s. And I think most veterinarians, especially of my generation, we went to veterinary school because we read his books and we fell in love with the profession and we fell in love with the human-animal bond through his stories. And his books were all set in the beautiful rolling green hills, the countryside of Yorkshire. My hospital was downtown, concrete, gangs, graffiti, drugs, drive-bys, hookers. I mean, complete opposite of what James Herriot had.
It's not idyllic, but animals are animals and they still need looking after, don't they?
Well, you nailed that. I mean, absolutely, positively. I mean, the book is really a tribute to the human-animal bond. And do you have pets, Selena?
I certainly do. Yeah, I've got two dogs. Okay.
There you go. So, I mean, you know how much you love them. And It's interesting. It doesn't matter where you live, whether it's the countryside of England or the downtown Los Angeles. We love our animals. And that love for the human-animal bond is so strong. It doesn't matter where it is. The big difference was in England, James Herriot took care of a sick horse and he got paid in pecan pie. In Los Angeles, you know, you took care of a sick dog and then you were lucky if you didn't get shot walking to your car.
No. And did you have any problems getting paid?
Yeah, every once in a while we would. The thing is that veterinarians don't do what we do for the money. We do it because we love the animals. We do it because we want to support that human-animal bond. We want to keep it strong. And if a patient comes in and they need help, you're not going to turn them away. I mean, at least most ethical veterinarians won't turn them away. They do everything they can to try and help them. So there are certainly many cases where we didn't get paid. But, you know, it's okay because if we were able to help the animal, it was worth it in the long run.
Yeah, I totally get that. And you had some exotic animals as well, I believe.
Yeah, we did. It's interesting. My background is a little different than many veterinarians, and that is I was trained in zoo animal medicine. And so because of that, I was one of the very few veterinarians in Southern California that was treating exotic pets. When I say exotic pets, I mean things like monkeys, snakes, big birds, that kind of a stuff. We also did dogs and cats and rabbits, but we developed this reputation for working with kind of crazy animals. And that's kind of how the name of the hospital came about, because we had a little bit of everything that would come in to see us.
But not times two.
No, oftentimes not times two.
Yeah, I was reading that you're just as likely to be treating a lion as a house cat. I mean, surely you can't treat a lion at your clinic. You'd have to go out to it, would you?
You know, interesting that you say that, because we had a couple, we had one particular movie star client that had a couple pet tigers. And they were very well trained, and he would bring his tigers into the hospital on a leash. But we would have them come in the afternoon or in the evening after the hospital was closed, because you don't need to have somebody walking a tiger into your hospital and then have a dog in the in the waiting room barking at it. So you have to use some common sense. But most of the stuff that was really big, we would go out in the field and take care of it.
Yeah. I was reading that you've treated emus and skunks as well. Have you ever been sprayed by a skunk?
Yes. There's a vignette in the book about a very wealthy lady who is an heir to a very large perfume company. So I always thought it was kind of odd that the woman who created her millions based on pleasant odors kept a skunk as a pet. But she used to have all of her skunks descented. And we had a policy that when they would come in for descenting, they would stay outside the building, go around the backyard. We would do it outside. We could safely do it outside. Well, we had one young receptionist who didn't know the policy. And when a woman came in with a skunk, she had her bring the skunk into the reception area. And of course, a dog saw the skunk and barked at the skunk, and the skunk immediately cut loose and just sprayed everybody in the reception area. And then our hospital reeked of skunk for the next 2 weeks.
Oh, no. And talking of old ladies, apparently there's another little old lady who is one of your favorite clients who had a pet Congo eel.
Oh, yeah. I think of all the patients that I've had over the years, this one was definitely one of the most unusual. We got called out on a house call from a little old lady. She had to be in her 70s or 80s, and she had a Congo fire eel that lived in her bathtub for 16 years. And she called us because it wasn't eating, and she had no way to bring it into the hospital. So I went out with my students, took a look at the fire eel, and we could tell right away that it was in heart failure. So the question you have is, well, how do you know that? And I don't really know, because it's not like we see a lot of Congo fire eels. Well, we ended up bringing the animal back to the hospital to try and put it on heart medications, but it was an older fire eel. And unfortunately, as some of our patients do, whether it's a pet or a human in a human hospital, it didn't make it. So it was pretty sad. And she was just devastated because she'd had that eel for so many years.
Oh, such an unusual pet to have, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. You know, could you imagine having somebody come over to your house and they see your dogs and they play with your dogs and then they say, oh, would you want to meet my pet eel in the bathtub?
Give it a treat.
Yeah.
So when that happens, Doug, when sadly patients do die, or you have to even intervene and end their life to stop them being in pain, you're only human, and as you say, you love the animals. Is it tough? Can you leave it at the door when you leave the surgery, or do you take the feelings home with you?
I'll tell you what, Selena, you know, I mean, I've been a veterinarian for almost 40 years and treated thousands and thousands and thousands of patients. I don't remember the vast majority of them, but the ones that I remember are the ones that I lost. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, when a patient passes away, yes, you take it home, and sometimes it haunts you for days, if not longer. You know, and you'll go several nights without sleep. And it just, I think, you know, that's one of the things that leads to burnout in a lot of the veterinarians and in human doctors as well. It's tough. You know, I mean, we want to walk on water. We want to save everything. Reality is you can't. Try the best you possibly can. You read all your books, you do all your studying, you want to be the best doctor, but sometimes you just can't save them. And it hurts.
Yeah.
And it hurts the staff, it hurts the owners, you know, and even other animals will pain. Very common. You have two dogs, and God forbid someday if one dog ever passes, the other dogs, they go into mourning.
Yeah.
So it's really sad to lose a companion.
And I guess as well, you're getting to know the animals. If it's a regular pet that's been coming to you for years, you probably become attached to them as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's funny because I hear the young doctors and kids wanting to go into veterinary medicine saying, I want to be a veterinarian because I can't stand working with people. But that is the farthest from the truth you can imagine, because the veterinarians, our patients can't talk to us. So we depend on the owners to be the communication and the link, the bridge between us and the patient. And when they come in over and over and over again, not only do you become fond of the pet, but you become fond and become friends with the owners. Yeah. And so there's just a lot of dynamic there. And that's that human-animal bond I keep talking about, that we not only treat the pets, but we have to treat the owners as well. And unfortunately, the sad reality is, again, sometimes our patients pass away And that's just crushing.
Yeah.
And it's really hard.
Yes, I'm sure it is. Can you give any advice for anybody listening, any young person listening who wants to become a vet?
You know what? I hear all the time that the profession is getting really difficult and it shouldn't, you know, I would never go into veterinary medicine again, but I don't believe in that. I mean, I've been doing this for 40 years. I still like getting up every morning knowing that I can make a difference in somebody's life. So my recommendation is if you want to be a veterinarian, it's a lifestyle. It's not a job. You don't punch a clock and go in and go out. I mean, you're committed. If you're off at 5 o'clock and 4:45 comes around and an animal comes in an emergency, you don't go home and say, come back tomorrow. You stay there and take care of it. So I think if you're going to become a veterinarian, I'd strongly recommend you spend some time either working with or volunteering for a veterinary office so you can get an idea what the highs and lows are like, because the highs are wonderful. When you can cure that animal and send it home and prolong that human-animal bond, there's no feeling like it. And the flip side is when you lose a patient, which sadly anybody in medicine will occasionally happen, it can be devastating. So you have to be aware that it can be an emotional roller coaster. But again, I can think of no better profession. I wouldn't do anything else if I had to do it all over.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It was something I always wanted to do as a child. But then I decided not to because I knew I'd get too upset about having to put animals down. I'm a bit weak. But another one from your website, I saw is you had a bit of a hairy experience with a whale shark, and that's one of the biggest, isn't it?
I'm sorry, I missed that. With a what?
You had a bit of a hairy experience with a whale shark?
Oh, yeah. That didn't happen in Los Angeles. That happened when I moved here to the islands. We had a whale shark is the largest fish in the world. They can be 35 feet long when they're full grown. And I live in an archipelago of islands. There's 43 islands connected by 42 bridges. And this young whale shark, which was just about 25 feet long, so it was still a baby, got tangled up in ropes. And it swam underneath one of the bridges. And it was feeding on krill as the tide changed. And long story short, if the rope around the tail doesn't get cut off, it cuts off the blood supply to the tail, and the tail will die, and then the whale shark dies. So I went out with the Coast Guard, and I dove down with a knife, and I was able to actually swim up to the whale shark and then cut the rope off the shark. But as soon as I grabbed the shark to cut the rope, it dove, and it started diving down deeper and deeper and deeper, and I wasn't about to let it go because I was afraid that if I let it go, I wouldn't catch it again, and the tail could fall off and die. So by the time I finally got the rope cut off, I was probably 30, 40, 50 feet deep and running out of air. And I didn't know that I was going to make it back to the surface, but fortunately I did, live to tell the story, and the whale shark lived to live another day. So It worked out okay.
Brilliant. And I'm just looking at your Zoom link, and there's a picture of you with, is it an alligator or a crocodile?
Yeah, that's an alligator. That's Casper. He's been one of my patients for about 20 years. I don't recommend people jump in the river or in a pond with an alligator. But like I said, I've been working with this particular alligator for about 20 years, and it knows me and I know it. I mean, literally, I can walk up to the pond and call its name, and it'll lift up its head, look for me, and then swim over to me. He's got some big teeth, and if he wanted to eat me, he could. But fortunately, we have enough respect for each other that we can get in the pond and go for an alligator swim.
Amazing. Well, I know you've written many, many books, but the one we're talking about today is called The Vet at Noah's Ark, Stories of Survival from an Inner City Animal Hospital. It's by Dr. Doug Mager, who we're speaking to today, and it came out in August. You can buy it from our website. Doug, do you have a website if people can find out more about you?
I do. It's www.dougmager.com, so it's pretty easy to find. And that gives you a little bit of background about me, talks about a couple of my other books, and it gives you a lot more information about this particular book, including some excerpts from the book itself.
Great stuff. Well, as an animal lover, it's been smashing to chat to you today. Thanks for getting up early and being on our show.
Thank you, Celine. I really appreciate it. And have a great the rest of your day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.